Minnesota respondent versus Emily Ray Hewitt appellant. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments, 5 minutes for rebuttal for appellant if you choose to use it. When you start your arguments, please state your name, the party you represent for the record. We're making an audio recording of it as usual. And appellant, well, you probably know, both know, the podium goes up and down. So go ahead, get yourself ready, and then whenever you're ready, we're ready for you.
Your Honor, is the...
There's a toggle with your right hand. There's a toggle switch in the front. Or center, yeah, sorry.
Thank you.
Guess I haven't done it in a while myself from that end.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Andrew Nelson. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this case, Emily Hewitt. In this case, Ms. Hewitt entered a standard guilty plea to felony DWI. However, her factual basis established that she did not remember any details of the DWI offense. Because a guilty plea, a standard guilty plea, must be based on the defendant's memory, Ms. Hewitt's plea is inaccurate. She asks this court to allow her to withdraw her guilty plea. Respondents concedes in their brief that Ms. Hewitt did not enter an accurate standard guilty plea. That should be the end of this court's analysis. However, respondent argues instead that because Ms. Hewitt did not remember the details of her offense, the proper procedure would have been to do a Norgaard plea. And respondent asked this court to analyze Ms. Hewitt's plea under Norgaard case law. This court should decline to do so because the record shows that Ms. Hewitt did not intend to enter, nor did she enter a Norgaard plea.
How do we do that if we decline to evaluate whether she did it?
Could you say
that
again?
Well, you said we should decline evaluating whether it's a valid Norgaard plea because she didn't intend to do it and didn't do it, but that sort of strikes me as looking at whether she did it. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. So my argument today is that this case before you today is a standard guilty plea case. It's a standard guilty plea case, like the unpublished Williams decision cited in my brief, where the defendant lacked memory of certain elements of the offense. Because she lacked memory, her testimony could not satisfy the elements of her offense, and therefore this is a very straightforward, inaccurate standard guilty plea case.
I guess my question is, does someone have to say we're doing Norgaard, which I think they should, right, as a best practice, it's a Norgaard plea. Is that what stops it from being evaluated, in your view, why we should not turn to whether it's a valid Norgaard plea because they didn't identify it as a Norgaard plea? Or
Judge Smith, that is part of the analysis. So I would agree that calling the plea that you're entering a Norgaard plea is part of this process. And I guess that's probably the best place to start. So in this case, we had a plea petition, which was presumably filled out with Ms. Hewitt and her attorney before the plea was entered. What's interesting in this case is the petition that was used is an Appendix A petition, which is the petition we use for standard guilty pleas. There's a separate addendum or appendix that's used for Norgaard pleas. That's Appendix H. So in this case, I would argue this wasn't a slip up on the attorney's behalf where they just forgot to call this a Norgaard plea. Let me ask you this.
I don't think that Minnesota's Supreme Court case law requires that a defendant say, "I'm entering a Norgaard plea." Would you agree with that? I couldn't find a Supreme Court case that requires that.
Your Honor, I would agree that there's no express statement from the Supreme Court that you need to put the Norgaard label on a Norgaard plea. I would argue that it is implied. So in cases like State v. Ecker, the Supreme Court held that we need to accept Norgaard pleas, Alford pleas, with caution. The argument that I made in my reply brief is that a district court doesn't know when to apply caution if they don't know what kind of plea is before them.
Well, except your client had almost 0.24 blood alcohol and said that she was in one of the Brooklands and she thought she was in Eden Prairie and couldn't remember anything. Understandably so. And she said all of that when she started her plea.
That's correct. So the fact that Ms. Hewitt couldn't remember, and I agree with you, it's understandable why she couldn't remember in this case. The fact that she couldn't remember is a reason why a Norgaard plea should have been used. I think it should have suggested to the parties that that would have been the proper procedure. But it does not transform Ms. Hewitt's standard plea into a Norgaard plea.
It just seems like what you're pointing to are three things, at least three, maybe there are more, that are best practices, certainly, that didn't happen here. You know, not labeled a Norgaard plea, didn't attach a Norgaard addendum, you know, asked everything by leading questions. But none of them are requirements under precedent, clear requirements. Are you trying to say just kind of the accumulation of violating best practices is enough? Or, I mean, do we have to make new law to rule for you in that respect?
Your Honor, you do not need to make new law to rule on my client's behalf in this case. So I would agree that a lot of these things are, you maybe could attach a best practices label to them. So calling the plea that you're entering a Norgaard plea, using open-ended questions instead of leading questions, those are all things that maybe on their own aren't enough, but cumulatively or considered in the totality might be enough. There is one thing in this case that on its own does invalidate the plea, and that would be the failure for Ms. Hewitt to say, I acknowledge that the state's evidence, if presented to a jury, would be sufficient to convict.
But does she have to use those exact words? Because I'm kind of looking at this. Would you agree that if both these things were true? That both these things are true? You know, that question and answer. Why isn't that acknowledging that the evidence persuaded her she is guilty?
So, Your Honor, I think that statement gets us close. But this court and the Supreme Court has been very clear that close isn't enough. This court has even reversed in unpublished cases where the defendant says something like, yeah, there's a possibility if this was presented, I'd be convicted. This court's been very particular with the specific words that have to be said in order for a Norgaard plea to be valid.
But it doesn't say, it says, would you agree that both those things, kind of the two things that need to be there for DWI offense, would you agree that both those things were true on this date and that she answers yes? She's not saying possibly, right?
Yep. And I would have two responses to that, Your Honor. So the first response is Ms. Hewitt had a 0.22 or a 0.24 BAC. So she doesn't know what's true. She has no recollection of what is true in this case. But also, once again, it doesn't get us to the specific finding that she's agreeing that if that evidence was presented to a jury, they would convict her. What she subjectively believes is true is different than her belief that if it was presented to a jury, they would reach a guilty verdict. I would also like to briefly touch on the leading questions in this case. And as I mentioned to Judge Jessen, leading questions have never been the sole reason why this court is willing to reverse. But it is an important consideration in this case. When you read through the plea hearing transcript, it's very clear that Ms. Hewitt was limited to monosyllabic answers. She was limited to saying yes. Her attorney told her what to say as he walked her through the factual basis. And even more so, I would argue that when she tried to provide more, she was stopped from doing so. And this is a circumstance, which I will continue to argue before this court, that renders a guilty plea inaccurate. So even if this court does disagree with me and address this case as a Norgaard plea, I would still encourage this court to find that it's inaccurate. Because not only was it not called a Norgaard plea, not only were the magic words not said in this case, but leading questions were used.
I was just looking to see, because in Norgaard, it affirms the guilty plea, although obviously they didn't call it a Norgaard plea because it's Norgaard. So, you know, I know that the best practices have developed since, you know, when is this, 1961, but I don't see the Supreme Court mandating that since then.
Mandating what, Your Honor?
That you refer to this case and identify this particular type of plea when actually in Norgaard the Supreme Court rather, didn't reverse the plea, notwithstanding it was a, quote, Norgaard plea from then on, so.
Your Honor, I would argue that the more relevant case law on this issue are cases like these, cases like Ecker. Mm-hmm. Norgaard is a little bit like Austin, if this court's familiar with Austin, mm-hmm. where Austin said, here's the procedure going forward, we're not applying it in this case. And so just because the court in Norgaard didn't follow its own procedure, it was prospectively adopting this procedure going forward. Mm-hmm. And on the issue of, again, attaching this label to a Norgaard plea, my argument is that a court cannot apply extra caution, which they're required to do, if they don't know that the plea before them is a Norgaard. And I think that's the situation that the district court was presented with here.
Well, except I think that most district court judges who had someone like your client in front of them who was really drunk the day of the offense would understand that they don't remember very much, if anything.
Yes.
you would assume, I would assume that as a district court judge.
And I would assume that too, Your Honor. Essentially, Norgard was built for cases like this case, where a defendant drinks so much that they can't remember what happened. But once again, the fact that Ms. Hewitt couldn't remember, I think should have been a cue to the court that this should have been a Norgard plea. It doesn't transform this plea into a Norgard plea. Unless this court has any further questions, I'll just ask this court to reverse. Thank you.
Great. You'll have your 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Nicole Cornell. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this matter. Based on this court's questioning so far, I will keep my oral argument brief, but I do want to touch on just a few things. One, this case regards appellant driving and crashing her car while she was intoxicated with a blood alcohol level nearly three times the legal driving limit. And as Judge Riley has pointed out, it is unsurprising that she entered a valid Norgard plea as a result due to her loss of memory. And on appeal, as this court is already aware, it is appellant's burden to show that her valid plea was invalid in some way, and appellant has failed to carry that burden. There is no manifest injustice based on this record that this court needs to correct, and therefore this court should affirm. If I may touch on one thing before asking this court to affirm once more, and it is a sort of subtle distinction in State versus Ecker that I think might be helpful to this court. There are two ways that a factual basis can be sufficient under Eckerd for a Norgard plea to be constitutionally valid.
I want to ask you a question because appellant says that the guilty plea was inaccurate, doesn't argue that it was involuntary, but just inaccurate. And so are you saying that sufficiency goes to accuracy?
That a sufficient factual basis supports the accuracy and thus supports a valid plea?
Right.
I don't disagree with that. But I would caution this court when appellant is sort of leaning heavily on his leading question argument, I do think that gets much more toward the voluntary issue, which appellant did not raise, and it is not supporting his argument about lack of accuracy. And again, respondent's position is that the plea was accurate. And the plea was accurate because there are two ways under Ecker that a sufficient factual basis supports the accuracy element of a valid plea. And according to Ecker, one way is that the record must establish that evidence against a defendant is sufficient to persuade the defendant that the defendant is guilty. And in this case, the appellant did say she was pleading guilty because she is guilty. And as her counsel talked about the evidence in this case, she acknowledged the evidence, she acknowledged the police reports, she acknowledged the statements that she made to police, she acknowledged her blood alcohol level, she acknowledged that she had a half-empty vodka bottle in her car, that she was in physical control, and that she agreed that the circumstances were present and true, as Judge Jessen pointed out, such that all the elements of first-degree DWI were met in this case. So based on that language and that the circumstances were true to make her guilty, she was convinced of her own guilt. That is one way under Ecker that the factual basis was met, and therefore her plea was accurate. And the second way, which I believe appellant, if I'm reading his brief correctly, is sort of emphasizing or hanging his hat on, it's that Ecker says the record must establish evidence against the defendant is sufficient to persuade the defendant that a jury would convict them of the crime. So again, Ecker says there's two ways to satisfy a factual basis. One is the defendant themselves is convinced of their guilt, or the defendant is convinced that a jury would be convinced of their guilt. And it's respondent's position that both of those avenues were satisfied based on this record, but most certainly appellant herself was convinced that based on the evidence she was guilty. And I won't belabor the point, but at the end of the day,
I'm sorry. Just to get to that. So, I mean,
you know, the appellant cites a lot of Court of Appeals case law where we outline the general rule, and Court of Appeals published case law talks about the need to have the defendant acknowledge evidence sufficient to find the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Is it just that we haven't explored that other, you know, convince the defendant that it's in fact, that they're in fact guilty? That, I mean, you don't, it strikes me that our, you know, he's not wrong to say our case law has required that, at least described it. You're saying, well, no, let's just put that aside and go right up to the Supreme Court and say, well, there are two ways. One is, you know, the record is sufficient, the acknowledgement the record is sufficient to convince a jury versus, you know, just believing it to be true, and then it doesn't matter whether the record is convinces them that they'd be found guilty. I don't really see that Court of Appeals case law has, like, necessarily followed that sort of two, you know, tier or two direction kind of tree.
Sure. I do think I follow what Your Honor is saying, that if the Minnesota Supreme Court has described such a split and two essentially avenues to satisfy the factual basis for a Norgaard plea, that they still exist. And I haven't read every single Court of Appeals case since Ecker regarding Ecker and the two avenues. But I wouldn't disagree with Your Honor that perhaps this court hasn't explored essentially affirming based on one of those avenues and not both, or not addressing one and emphasizing the second, if that makes sense. So I'm not aware.
And do you agree with the appellant that the defendant here, the appellant did not acknowledge that the evidence would be sufficient for a jury to find her guilty beyond a reasonable doubt?
I do disagree.
You do disagree. So even under the second path, do you think that that was satisfied?
Absolutely.
And why?
And the reason is, similar to what Judge Justin had been asking about, regarding appellant admitting that the circumstances were true. Truth is a standard far higher than proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It is far higher than likelihood of a jury convicting. So the likelihood of a jury convicting is a standard under Norgaard, and also that the jury uses the standard proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Truth is a much higher standard than both. And so by appellant going through painstakingly a summary of the evidence that would be presented against her and acknowledging that she just gave up those jury trial rights, including that the state would be held to its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, she went through the summary of the evidence and then admitted that the circumstances were true. And if the circumstances are true, that standard is beyond a reasonable doubt, way higher than that standard. And so both avenues are satisfied in this case.
So if someone reads a record, a defendant reads a record, mm-hmm. shown a record, mm-hmm. doesn't recall it, comes to believe it's true, mm-hmm. you're saying that necessarily establishes that the record is sufficient for a jury, that she acknowledges the record is sufficient for a jury to find beyond a reasonable doubt. I guess that's if her definition of true, if she employs the reasonable doubt standard to her own decision making.
Well, I agree that the words beyond a reasonable doubt and a jury's finding of that weren't present in the colloquy here. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing the word colloquy correctly.
I believe you are.
Thank you. but the interesting thing about this case is that to me, it was remarkable that a defense counsel could put such a concept in layman's terms. I think that was one of the best ways that I've seen explain to a non-attorney what the elements are and what the facts were to meet those elements and that they were true. And that is much more useful, relatable, meaningful language to a non-attorney than if the defense counsel were to have read the Norgaard addendum in its entirety. And I think that it is important for this court to not adopt a rule that says you need to read the Norgaard addendum word for word, because that is unrealistic. I myself would have to look up some of the words. So to sort of use the Norgaard addendum as a rubber stamp and a requirement is a disservice to defendants who don't understand legal language and also who don't have an exact memory of the events at the time. So in those two regards, I do think the plea was remarkably explained. But at the end of the day, to invalidate a plea based on accuracy is not appropriate in this case, because at the end of the day, this court is not concerned that appellant pled guilty to a more serious offense than she would have been convicted at trial if she had taken the matter to trial. And in sum, appellant's Norgaard plea was constitutionally valid. In exchange for her plea, she was even given a bottom-of-the-box guideline sentence. There is no manifest injustice to correct, and this court should affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And counsel for appellant.
There are 3 points I'd like to make on rebuttal. The first is that respondent focuses on why this is or is not an accurate Norgaard plea. Again, my argument before this court is that this isn't a Norgaard plea at all. This was a standard guilty plea, and there's nothing in the record besides the mere fact that Ms. Hewitt couldn't remember the details to say that this is a Norgaard plea.
So your client was charged with one count?
That's correct.
I mean, the felony DUI. And so the purpose of making sure that a plea is accurate is that it protects people like your client from pleading guilty to a more serious offense than he or she would be found guilty of at trial.
That's correct.
I'm trying to understand how this guilty plea implicates that rule.
So I have two responses to that, Your Honor. So the first response is that it is a built-in protection, the phrase that you've quoted. We've all quoted it in our guilty plea briefs. It's a protection that's built in to protect defendants. Norgaard pleas have their own built-in protections. And I'm not familiar with what case that rule of law came from. I would assume it's not a Norgaard case. And the protections that are built into a Norgaard plea are that the court should accept it with caution, and the defendant has to admit that a jury would find them guilty beyond reasonable doubt. So I'm not entirely sure that protection is needed in a Norgaard case. Even if it is needed in a Norgaard case, I would argue what shows or what causes a risk that Ms. Hewitt could be convicted of a crime more serious than she pled to are the leading questions in this case. The Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court, the rules of procedure are very clear that leading questions have no place in a factual basis, whether it's a standard plea, a Norgaard plea, or an Alford plea. A defendant is supposed to say in their own words what happened. And when a defense attorney puts the words in their client's mouth, tells them what to say, tells them how to answer, I think that's where we get into the territory of worrying that the defendant's pleading guilty to something more serious. The second point I wanted to make is that even if we are in Norgaard land, even if this is a Norgaard plea, respondent argues that there's two ways to satisfy that express finding. That Ecker says you can either persuade the defendant that he's guilty or the defendant can be persuaded a jury would find them guilty. Like counsel, I didn't read every single case since Ecker, but I have not run across a single case that applies that first avenue. I haven't found a single case where this court has held the defendant satisfied a Norgaard factual basis by admitting that they were persuaded that they were guilty. The Norgaard addendum, which is Appendix H to Rule 15, in two different places talks about how the defendant admits that a jury would find them guilty. It never utilizes that first avenue, that the defendant is persuaded. And so I would argue that there are not two ways to satisfy, there's only one. And every case that's applied Ecker has applied that one. The final point I want to make is that leading questions do go directly to accuracy. They only deal with accuracy. And that's because the rules of procedure say the defendant must state in his own words why he's guilty of a crime. That's what's required for a factual basis. And the accuracy requirement focuses on whether the factual basis is satisfied. So it doesn't go to involuntariness. It doesn't go to intelligence. It goes centrally to accuracy. And with that, I just ask this court to reverse Ms. Hewitt's plea.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both for your very helpful briefs and arguments. Thanks for not taking more time than you need. We appreciate that. Very focused arguments. We appreciate that. Case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period.